This is a Sandler Training audiobook, produced and distributed by Ascent Audio, a division of Recorded Books, in partnership with Sandler Training. Making the Climb, From Salesperson to Sales Manager and Beyond, by Peter Oliver, narrated by Roger Wayne. We hope you enjoy this program. Forward. The transition from sales contributor to sales leader is one of the most important and challenging in all of business. Yet, most people who embark on this journey receive little or no training and support in preparation for it. There is a certain sink-or-swim mentality when it comes to identifying and promoting emerging sales leadership talent. And that is a shame. Peter Oliver's breakthrough book challenges that way of thinking. It is an indispensable resource for any salesperson contemplating the transition into a leadership position, for any leader mentoring such a salesperson, and indeed for anyone interested in developing sales professionals to their fullest and highest potential. Read it, share it, implement its ideas, and spread the word. Becoming the head of finance or the head of research and development or the head of personnel requires preparation, training, and support. And becoming the head of a sales team does too. David Mattson, President and CEO, Sandler Training. Introduction. This is a book for someone making the transition from salesperson to sales leader and for the person managing that salesperson. It offers insights designed to be equally helpful to both, whether they are reading it separately or jointly. I call the transition to sales leadership making the climb because it is a truly daunting journey akin to scaling a mountain. Planning for and executing this journey is a topic near and dear to my heart. It is one that I have made myself, and one that I have helped countless others to make. I know firsthand that this transition can feel like leaping across a chasm with a huge drop beneath you. It is that scary. Why is it often so scary? It's a result of one of the most common and risky decisions in fast-growing organizations. Tapping top sales performers on the shoulder and promoting them into leadership roles with little or no preparation or training. The thinking goes like this. So-and-so is our best salesperson. Let's make him a leader. Maybe he can get the team to sell like he does. Or, she is clearly the smartest person on the team, so obviously she should be in charge. Or, we can't let these two go to the competition, so let's give them those open territories as managers and see what they can do. The impulses that drive this kind of thinking are understandable. There is definitely an advantage to promoting from within. After all, if you don't, your top performers will likely go elsewhere to continue their career growth. It's true, too, that if someone is transitioned in a way that supports them, the team, and the organization, they can have a huge impact on the success of the business. The question is, how do you successfully promote from within to create truly effective sales leaders? All too often, the transition ends in frustration, stress, disengagement, burnout, and lost opportunities. And I don't just mean revenue opportunities. Here is the challenge that is easy to overlook. Some of the characteristics that make someone a rock star contributor as a salesperson can end up being a huge detriment to them as a leader. For instance, the often praised ability to think on your feet and think outside the box may show up as praiseworthy creativity and initiative when someone is a contributor. But as a lack of discipline and the inability to define and implement a common sales process once that same person is promoted to management. This is just one of dozens, probably hundreds, of ways that behaviors that earn approval and commissions when someone is selling for a living can show up as a profound mismatch when a sink or swim promotion comes along. The consequences of such a promotion are potentially disastrous. If the transition to leader is not properly supported, it can crush the culture of the team. Performance will go down, pipelines will suffer, and good people will leave. Clearly, the stakes are very high. In this book, I'll take a look at the most common pitfalls emerging sales leaders face, the best ways to avoid them, and the mindsets, key behaviors, and skills needed to achieve success in the role they are preparing themselves for. And the role is worth preparing for. Why? Because the transition from individual contributor to manager is not only among the toughest you can make, it is also the one that offers the most upside and downside in terms of opportunities and challenges. I wrote this book to help organizations and top-performing sales professionals prepare for and execute the transition into a sustainable career as a true sales leader. Too many people stumble into this role and then are expected to stumble upon the keys to success all on their own. That's a lot to ask of anyone. I believe you shouldn't be expected to develop by chance into the next successful sales leader. My aim is to help salespeople emerge on purpose into the next phase of their career and become true sales leaders. How it happened to me. For many people, the jump to manager is a rude awakening. For me, it was more like a punch in the face. Early in my career, I was offered the opportunity to manage a technology sales team. I immediately said yes. Why not? I was a goal-driven guy with a relentless work ethic. I had risen up to the sales ranks in my organization very quickly. The promotion seemed like the logical next step. I'd overcome all kinds of challenges to get as far as I had, as fast as I had. This would be the next challenge, and I would overcome this one too. I would do what I had always done, figure things out as I went along. How hard could it be? Suddenly, I was a 28-year-old kid in charge of 16 sales representatives and a $100 million book of business. Only after I had accepted the job did it occur to me that two-thirds of my team was older than I was. This would present a challenge somewhat different than the other challenges I had overcome in my brief career. Here is a partial list of things I had never done before the first day I showed up for work as a sales manager. 1. Manage anyone. 2. Make a hiring decision. 3. Fire a person or accept a resignation. 4. Give a performance review. 5. Coach a person who had 20 more years of experience than I did. 6. Onboard a person with no experience. 7. Onboard a person with deep experience. 8. Deal with internal management politics. 9. Influence interdepartmental decisions. 10. Create a one-year business plan that impacted anyone other than myself. 11. Manage a profit and loss statement. 12. Mentor an employee having challenges with internal relationships. 13. Deal with any human resource issue. 14. Run a team meeting. 15. Interview a candidate. 16. Inspect, evaluate, or offer meaningful feedback about a team's pipeline. 17. Create a template for quarterly or annual business reviews with key clients. 18. Set team goals and make sure they are in alignment with team members' individual goals. 19. Create a new job description. 20. Give a management update to our leadership team. I could keep going, but you get the idea. From a formal point of view, the point of view, frankly, that would have guided any hiring decision about a critical management role in any other area of that company, I had virtually no experience or qualifications in at least 20 key areas of responsibility. But since I could consistently execute above quota in my role as an individual contributor, I got the promotion. You see any problems on the horizon? Once I started to get the lay of the land, I saw those problems ahead. But in response, I tried to pretend that I was Superman. Problems, I thought. I eat those for breakfast, and I do it without any help from anyone. That had been my mindset as a contributor, and I saw no reason to change that outlook now that I'd been promoted to management. The challenges started rolling in right away. My third day on the job, I had an employee come into my office very upset, telling me she needed to go on leave because her parents were sick. Not only that, her parents had a gaping hole in the ceiling of their house, and it was raining in their living room. Would I authorize an extended leave of absence and keep paying her while she was gone? I had no clue what to do. Was I supposed to empathize with her? Push back? Ask her about the state of her sales pipeline? Ask her to commit to a return date? Let her take a few days off and ask her to check back in when she had a better sense of when she would be able to come back? I had nothing. But luckily for me, my good sense instincts kicked in. I had nothing, so I did nothing. until I talked to the resources in my organization who had the answers. Some recently hired sales leaders in situations like this have been known to make snap decisions on the spot, on the theory that not making a decision is a sign of weakness. Those decisions are usually disastrous. Fortunately, in my case, the people in HR were able to coach me through the appropriate process. But I knew it could have turned out very differently if I hadn't asked for that advice and guidance. Here I was, a brand new leader, excited about the opportunity to impact my team's success, and I found myself, in the very first week, having to invest major time, effort, and energy on something that I was utterly unprepared for. As it turned out, there were plenty of management issues that were not only not in the job description, but well beyond both my expectations and my experience base. I still had to deal with them. Welcome to management. I was fortunate. I worked for a great company with a supportive, team-driven culture. I had great mentors who helped keep me on the right path. I had a great team that allowed me to earn their respect while showing me respect in return. But what if I hadn't had any of those things? What if I had been missing even one of those things? How could I have possibly climbed the mountain I found myself staring at? Now, don't get me wrong. I love being a manager, but I need to level with you at this point. I didn't get into management just to manage. I got into management to impact success, to drive the team in the right direction, and to advance my career. I saw the impact that my managers and mentors had had on me, and I wanted to have that same impact on my team. In the early going, I got a taste of just how much work and learning were going to be necessary for me to achieve that goal. The day-to-day management issues were coming at me hard and fast. I couldn't shake the feeling that I had little or nothing in the way of arrows to pull out of my quiver to fire at them. I'll make a long story short and tell you now that I made a ton of mistakes along the way. I learned many lessons, some of them painful, some of them expensive, some of them both. I'll share the most important of those lessons so that you don't have to make the same mistakes, whether you are the emerging sales leader or the person mentoring that leader. I'll give you a framework that will prepare you or those you mentor for a smooth transition to leadership success, and I'll share the management behavior plan I have used to guide the behaviors of the salespeople who report to me. It's based on the behavior plan called the Sandler Cookbook for Success. I wrote this book for leaders who believe in promoting from within, and for salespeople who want to emerge on purpose as sales leaders in their own right. If you fall into either category, my message to you is simple. Let's get started. Chapter 1. Why New Leaders Fail. In this chapter, I will share with you three of the most common misconceptions about why sales leaders fail to thrive or to be fulfilled in this position. Bottom line, many mentors and mentees resist asking the all-important question about the sales leader's role. Where are things most likely to go wrong? It's an essential conversation, so essential that I want to begin the main portion of this book with it. The Superhero Syndrome. Let's start by acknowledging that failure is an integral part of success, a point that is often overlooked by new sales leaders. No one has a clear path to the promised land. There are always pitfalls and roadblocks in the way for anyone aspiring to fulfill their true potential within a given role, especially for someone aspiring to a leadership position. So you need to be very clear about this dynamic up front. You will fail. That is the only path to learning and the only path to mastery. If you imagine you are a superhero or try to act as though that's who you are, the person with all the right answers all the time, then you will let other people down, you will let yourself down, and you won't learn what you need to learn. Eventually, you'll talk yourself into staying inside your comfort zone out of fear by continuing to repeat what sort of went okay yesterday. Read this part again. You will fail. That is not up for discussion. However, if that statement makes you uncomfortable, rest assured you're listening to the right book. I'll be addressing how to handle failure later on. The question is, will you learn from the failure and persevere? The only real failure is if you do nothing or give up trying. That covers the first and potentially most dangerous misconception, which sounds like this. You are strong and effective as a leader to the degree that you persuade others or yourself that you do not or cannot make mistakes. Holding this dysfunctional belief is one of the major reasons sales leaders fail. In fact, it may be the single biggest reason. This belief is what leads many aspiring sales leaders to micromanage. In my podcast, Emerge on Purpose, I interview successful sales leaders. I often ask, what was the biggest mistake they made early in their leadership career? Many of them describe a mindset I call the super salesperson. New leaders, especially those who excelled as sales contributors, often believe themselves invincible and assume they need to rescue everyone and everything. They may feel the need to demonstrate their awesomeness at every turn and prove to everyone in the organization just why they were chosen for this job over other people. This is the thinking. 2 days ago, I was a peer. Now I am the boss, so I had better prove to everyone that I really do belong here. This way of thinking is a serious mistake. Here's a timeless story. A new manager gets called into the office of the VP who doesn't look happy. The VP says, "Sit down. Look, you were a great salesperson, right?" "Yes," says the new manager, flashing a proud little smile. "And why was that?" asks the VP. The new manager shrugs and says, "I give up." "Why was that?" "Because I stayed out of your stuff." Actually, the VP uses another word than stuff, but you get the idea. The new manager's smile slowly fades away. "Here's the moral of the story," the VP says. "Stay out of your people's stuff." And with that, the new manager left the room, pondering those words of wisdom. Stay out of your people's stuff. And what did that VP mean? Basically, staying out of people's stuff means to let them drive their own car. Every once in a great while, you might want to point out a shortcut or a cool restaurant they could visit along the way. But don't yank the wheel away from them while they're driving. That's dangerous. It can create resentment or, even worse, a culture of learned helplessness. Either will lead to a downward team spiral and a crash. That's not what you want. You are not a superhero. You do not have the answer to every question or the solution to every problem. Even if you did, it's not your job to answer every question or solve every problem. The control paradox. The next misconception I'll highlight has to do with something called the control paradox. Let's say you own your house, and you also are the mayor of your small town. Will you manage the town the same way you manage your house? The answer is obviously no. You can't go around mowing everyone's lawn for them. You can't decide to unilaterally destroy the town square and build a shopping mall. You have to work with people if you want to get things done. The point here is simple, but surprisingly easy to miss. Whenever your world gets bigger, you have less personal control, not more. Now, why is this? As your span of responsibility increases, your ability to control things and do things yourself decreases. You become more reliant on relationships with others and less reliant on your own ability to complete a task personally. This is the nature of leadership. As a new leader, you need to embrace this dynamic, not fight it. Yes. You need to create the operating principles that will guide the team's success, but you can't go around house to house telling everyone that it's time to pay attention because you're going to show them how to mow the lawn. That is the, here, watch me do it, school of management. Would you want to work for a boss like that? No, thank you. Happiness in the workplace is directly linked to responsibility. The more responsibility you have for the events in your own life, the happier you can be. Now, how cool would it be if your leadership style promoted responsibility in others, not just yourself? Well, it can, by embracing a less controlling leadership style. One of the things I love about my business is I get to work with awesome organizations that demonstrate a proven track record of success. But even those organizations can make mistakes. One of the clients I worked with hired a terrible leader to manage their inside sales team. Within months of his arrival, a bunch of their top leaders and sales rock stars had left. Why? Because the new VP had not mastered the paradox of control lesson. He insisted that everything people had been doing before he showed up was wrong. Only his way was right. Basically, he either put you in jail or clipped your wings. Why? Because he wanted to make sure everyone knew there was a new sheriff in town, and he thought the best way to go about sending that message was to micromanage everything in sight. New leaders need to cultivate a trait called intellectual humility. This is simply having the courage not to automatically assume you're right, even when you're pretty sure you are. Intellectual humility allows leaders to see more clearly what isn't working, and more importantly, what is working. Intellectual humility means being willing to set aside the temptation to prove to others how right you are, or to make sure they do exactly what you would do in a given situation. It means being willing to check your ego at the door. You can be a strong leader without having a strong ego. I'll share some thoughts on creating and sustaining a working culture of intellectual humility in Chapter 7. Leadership doesn't equal control and authority. That's a dangerous misconception. Leadership does equal vision, purposeful change, and inspired action. The Ted Williams problem. One of the greatest players in the history of Major League Baseball was the Boston Red Sox slugger Ted Williams, the last man to have a .400 batting average. Yet Williams experienced far less success when he left the playing field and moved into the next phase of his career as a manager. And his team did steadily worse every year. Over 4 years as skipper, Williams won 273 games and lost 364. The team he led, the Texas Rangers, never made the postseason. He was fired in 1972 after the Rangers finished dead last, at which point Williams focused his efforts on fishing, a solitary sport in which he could excel. And why didn't Ted Williams, the manager, reach the same heights of achievement as Ted Williams, the player? You'll get a lot of different answers from a lot of different people. But the most consistent answer I have been able to track down is that Williams simply had no patience for athletes who were not capable of performing intuitively at the level at which he had been able to perform during his playing days. Meaning, basically, he had no respect for anyone who reported to him. Williams was particularly curt, short-tempered, and dismissive with pitchers, a group he admitted that he had never much liked. Not a great place to start if your goal is to set up a strong starting rotation or a great bullpen. As a one-in-a-million talent, Williams, the player, had done a lot of things by instinct, things that he often had trouble explaining to others who wanted to benefit from his experience. Another challenge was that he had little empathy for those who were depending on him as a leader. He was not interested in learning about the attitudes, aspirations, and abilities of players who were incapable of competing at his elite level. He believed they could succeed with only minimal coaching and support, as he had done. This was a major misconception and a major mistake. Like a lot of top-tier athletes who failed to make the transition into management, Williams had no respect for most of the people who reported to him because he believed they were not capable of or worthy of being considered his partners. As a result, he treated them as means to an end, not as people with unique gifts, aspirations, and potential. They noticed. Sadly, the same thing often happens when high-performing salesperson rock stars are promoted to management. They alienate some or all of their team for the simple reason that the members of the team can tell when they're being disrespected. This is the Ted Williams problem. It doesn't have to be that way. Know where the potholes are. If you know where the biggest potholes are ahead of time, it is much easier to steer around them. I have just shared the three biggest potholes emerging sales leaders face. In the chapters that follow, I'm going to share tools, ideas, and strategies that are proven to help emerging sales leaders avoid all three: the superhero syndrome, the control paradox, and the Ted Williams syndrome. Chapter takeaways. People fail. That's how they learn and grow. If you aren't seeking out failure, you are playing it safe. Learn to recognize and avoid the superhero syndrome, the control paradox, and the Ted Williams problem. Chapter 2. The Success Triangle. People, and especially people who sell for a living, sometimes ask me how we managed to get to Maui, where my family is now fortunate enough to live. I tell them, we usually fly United. Then they smile and say that's not what they meant. What they want is to know the secret that made it possible for our family to make paradise, which is the only way to describe Baby Beach in Paya, where I happen to be typing these words, my home base. There is no secret. That word implies concealment, and I make a habit of sharing what I know with aspiring sales leaders. In fact, I'm doing that right now. I'm putting everything I know about becoming a sales leader into this book for you. But I think what people are usually asking about when they ask this kind of thing is, what is the one most important lesson you've learned over the years about sales and sales leadership? That's a fair question, and it's the question this chapter is dedicated to answering. The single biggest lesson for me has been learning to leverage the success triangle, a simple personal development tool developed by David Sandler. And by the way, my most successful clients inevitably tell me that it's also the single biggest lesson for them. Now, perhaps you're wondering, why should the sales triangle matter to aspiring sales leaders or to anyone in sales? And what do the words behavior, attitude, and technique really mean in the triangle structure? Here's a true story that will start to answer those questions. I've been blessed with a loving wife, Lisa, and two amazing daughters, Bee and Lily. Years ago, when our daughters were just 2 and 3 years of age, we had a little incident that resulted in a nighttime emergency room visit. The evening started off innocently enough. Just like every night, we went through our bedtime routine with the kids. Now, at this point, I should tell you that my wife is Italian, which means it is basically a moral obligation for her to get each of our daughters' ears pierced at 3 months old. At least, that's how it is in her family. I was not part of the decision-making process on that one. So now you know that each of our little girls had pierced ears on the night in question. I have to say, they both looked really cute with their earrings on. Anyway, every once in a while, Lisa would have to do what we called a pokey with the girls to make sure the ear holes didn't close up. Basically, that's just putting a sterilized stud through the little hole in the ear. On this night, Lisa was doing pokey with our 3-year-old Lily, and the 2-year-old Bee disappeared into the bathroom. I saw her come back out a minute later with her hand to her ear and a weird look on her face. When I looked closer, I realized she had tried to put her earring in while we weren't looking. This was a small pearl earring without the backing on it, basically a stainless steel spear with a slippery, smooth ball on the end of it. Can you guess what she did? She put the earring in her ear canal. It was wedged in there, but visible. I started to go into panic mode. Lisa stayed calm and went to get the tweezers. Remember when you played the operations board game as a kid? Well, the buzzer went off on Lisa. The pearl was slippery, and the tweezers sent the pearl deeper into Bee's ear. I ran across the street to our neighbor's house, carrying Lily, the one without a dangerous metal spear wedged in her ear, like a sack of potatoes hurled over my shoulder. The neighbors saw the panic in my eyes as I explained what had happened. They agreed to take care of her. I ran back over to our house as fast as any 30-something ex-athlete could. Off to the emergency room we went. Bee was in no pain, but we were worried about her eardrum, and that earring obviously needed to come out. After a little bit of time in the waiting room, we took her into an examination room and waited for what seemed like an hour for the doctor to arrive. Finally, the doctor came in, and we told him what had happened. The doctor nodded and said, "I've seen this before." I thought to myself, "Cool, he's seen this before, no problem." "There is one thing I can try," the doctor continued. "But if it doesn't work, he will have to go to the eye and ear hospital for surgery." Lisa and I exchanged a worried glance. "What are you going to do?" I asked, nervous. He held up a cotton swab. "I'm going to take the wooden handle side of this cotton swab and put some superglue on the tip. I'll insert it in her ear. You must hold her still for 5 seconds to get the glue to bond to the pearl. Then, I'll pull it out." We were impressed. I said, "Wow, Doc, I love it. That's some MacGyver-like stuff you got going on. That's going to work." I held Bee while Lisa calmed her with soothing words. The nurse applied the superglue and handed it to the doctor. The doctor did his thing. No luck. The swab came out empty. My heart sank. Were we really looking at surgery? Next attempt. Once again, I held my little girl still. The doctor put the wooden tip into her ear. Out came the pearl. We all cheered. Bee was laughing and clapping. The nurse handed her a lollipop. No damage done. Her ear was fine.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?